Tim, an alcoholic.
Hey, Tim.
That was quick. Didn't even get into these cookies yet. So, I don't know why I brought them up here with me. My sobriety date is March 18, 2013. I have a sponsor. His name's John Edmonds. He's down in the Nashville area in big group down there. And I have a home group. My home group is the St. Bart's group. We meet on Monday nights at 8:30 off River Road in Bethesda, Maryland. It's, I guess I've gotten a reputation for saying this and they don't like it, but it's a pretty boring group. It's after my kids' bedtime. I've got three in diapers. It's close to the house. I don't dig myself a deeper hole with my wife because I can get all the kids down to bed and make it to the meeting consistently every week. And I have service and, you know, that kind of stuff is changing my program these days. But thank you, Dale, for asking me to come out and speak. I forgot that I was speaking. Called my wife today and told her when I had the kids out with me. We were getting Halloween decorations. And I was like, you texted me. And I was like, honey, you're going to kill me. But I'm leaving at 4 o'clock. And you got all three of them tonight. And she was like, you know, so she's not a huge fan of the Blue Ridge Speakers group, but I am. And it's been about 5 years since I spoke here last. You guys had me down here about 5 years ago. It was really nice. And thank you for reading page 29, wherever you are. Yeah, you got the hat. I didn't read it beforehand. And I would have gotten up here and made something up to sound intelligent from all you fine people. But I've never really sat down and sat all the way down in my chair and thought about it until you read it just now. And that's an interesting way to open the meeting. So I'll get into it and tell you guys a little bit about what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I'll try to fast forward through the early stuff because I got here just like the rest of you. You know, I drank and drugged my way into Alcoholics Anonymous. I got first introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous through the court slip system. So if you're here on a court slip, this is like an alumni reunion for you know, drug court and DUI court and all that stuff. I did all that for years and years and never got sober. But I certainly learned how to identify as an alcoholic. You know, every time I went in front of a judge, I said, no, you don't get it, Your Honor. I'm an alcoholic, you know, no matter what I did, you know. And sometimes some people argue, and I would be one of them that argues court might create more alcoholics than booze ever does, you know, because I meet people in Alcoholics Anonymous from all kinds of places. They're like, I came here, I did this. I'm like, oh, really? Sent you here. And, you know, but I grew up in Kensington, Maryland. I grew up in a big family. I had two sisters and a brother, and my mother's family is all from that Northwest DC area. She had 11 brothers, and they all live around Kensington, Maryland. So I had about 50 cousins, and we were like a small militia of short, overconfident egomaniacs running around Montgomery County, Northwest DC, and drinking was just a part of, you know, growing up. Drinking was what people did when they were having a good time, you know, and I'm sure anybody here can identify with that. You know, before taking a drink, I thought I couldn't wait to take a drink because it looked like everybody was having so much fun, you know. And by the time I was able to get my hands on some booze, whether it was stealing it from the adults or finding it in somebody's basement or what have you, I needed a drink. I was just like a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was restless, irritable, and discontent, you know, from the jump, frequently in a lot of trouble. And alcohol was a sufficient cure for alcoholism for a long, long, long time, you know. And I got in trouble early on, quite a bit of trouble, like peculiar things. You know, by the time I started drinking at an average age around here, and that's like 13, 14 years old. And I know in AA, that's not a record because, Alcoholics Anonymous, you say you start drinking at 13, 14 years old, somebody else is about to raise their hands. I started when I was 10. And then the person behind them is, I started drinking when I was 6 years old. And then pretty soon you go through the room and someone's like, I was dealing dope at in preschool, and that's Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, walk into any treatment center, that's exactly what's going on with all the knuckleheads, And it's peculiar because Alcoholics Anonymous has this in common with prison. Everybody competes to be the worst. It's the bizarrest thing, So I started drinking, like I said, average age, and pretty quickly I got into a lot of trouble. At 14 years old, I was drunk with a buddy I met at my high school, and we decided to steal some alcohol from his father, some liquor, and get drunk all day because we had off school that day, and it was 4/20/2000. And we were looking for some other stuff, and we wandered into a construction site in Olney, Maryland. In Olney, Maryland was a farm community, not quite as rural as this, but it was pretty rural back then. And they had a movie theater, and they were building up some townhouses and a town center set up. We walked into these townhouses that they were building. We started lighting cardboard boxes on fire and burned nine townhouses to the ground. And that's the kind of stuff I was bringing home when I was 14 years old. My parents were like clueless. I mean, where I grew up, very nice, well-to-do family. My parents were very well-to-do people. Neither one of them is alcoholic. There's plenty of alcoholism in the family. On both sides, but both of them very hardworking people, who had four children who all looked like me, blonde haired, blue eyed, soft looking white kid with like a lacrosse stick, not scaring anybody. But you couldn't have told me that. I would have told you I was the toughest guy in the neighborhood. But and the neighbors' kids weren't. They weren't having these problems. By the time it was a year or two later, I was being arrested for carrying concealed weapons on the DC Metro. And then the next year being arrested for assault. And then by the end of high school, I was getting thrown out and going off to like a boarding school. And that sounds fancy, but I wasn't going to a fancy boarding school. I was going to corrective boarding school, but I wouldn't tell people. I thought, I'm going to a boarding school in Maine. People are like, oh wow, that's fancy. I'm like, actually, it's prison. And my parents had no idea what to do. They had never dealt with something like this. I was just a tornado in the lives of my family members. And let's just fast forward through that. I went off to college, dropped out, got a job, started working in bars. Got DUIs, got introduced to AA through that process. A couple of DUIs, a couple long probation terms that required me to get drug tested and things like that and have the court slip. And God, I'll tell you, when I realized that I could drink and pass a drug test, it was like pouring gas on the fire because I wasn't going to do any of the other stuff that was going to get me in trouble. I was just going to pulverize plastic bottle vodka every night of the week, and I had to go to parole and probation every week, but every week I was fine. And what happened was is by the time I was 27 years old, I'd spent the last few years of my drinking, couch hopping, pretty much homeless. We call it functional homelessness. Sometimes I have somewhere to be, sometimes I don't. Hadn't spoken to my parents in years. The only conversation they were willing to have with me by that point was, "When are you going to go get some help?" Because I drank for many, many years, especially even through the end, thinking that I had a comeback right around the corner. You know, I always thought, you know, I would start drinking on Monday and be like, you know what? I know I didn't really do anything today, but I'm going to go to work tomorrow. I'm going to go to work on Tuesday. And I would have those few drinks. And when I started drinking, I knew I didn't do anything all day. But by one or two drinks in, I was patting myself on the back like I just done a hard day's work. Like, it's amazing that alcohol can do that for you. I mean, talk about change of perspective, you know. Lay in bed all day, hard day's work in a matter of a couple of drinks, you know. It's radical. You know, when I just did the fact that it could do that for me. And I discovered that at a young enough age, I really hitched my wagon to the star called alcohol, and I rode it to the precipice. By the end of it, I was having seizures almost daily. When I would go to work and start sobering up, I would break into the supply closet and I would huff the air duster that they use on keyboards and servers and in the data center and stuff. And I would huff the air duster to induce a grand mal seizure to knock myself unconscious to get through the rest of the workday, hiding in a bathroom or a server room, crazy stuff, you know? And I thought it was like, you know, I was just, this was survival at the end. But I thought I was, you know, I had a job. I didn't have anywhere to live, but I had a job. I was riding a moped to and from work at this time for years. And this isn't Palm Beach. This is DC. This isn't like normal to ride a moped in this weather outside, you know. And in DC and around here, you're well aware it's not all that snowy. It's really like 35, 36 degrees and rainy for like 4 or 5 months. And if you're riding a moped and it's 35 degrees and rainy, you're getting hit in the eyeballs with stinging rain while you're going down Connecticut Avenue or Wisconsin Avenue. And my solution to that at the end of my drinking was just close my eyes. I'll just drive a moped up and down Connecticut Avenue with my eyeballs closed, you know? And they changed the law in Maryland and Virginia that you had to start wearing a helmet and you had to have a driver's license and you had to have some form of motorcycle insurance on these mopeds. So I got my license. I went in and had them renew my license. I had a week before. I hadn't driven in years because of the several DUIs. But they renewed my license. I was annihilated drunk at the DMV. I don't know how I walked in there and walked out with a new license. But I got a insurance quote from Geico for it's a $1,000 moped. So not a lot that I could afford that. But a motorcycle helmet's expensive. Motorcycle helmet's like $400, $500. That's a lot of plastic bottle vodka. That's a lot of plastic bottle vodka. So my solution to that at this time at about 25 years old, I was going to break into my parents' house and look for my childhood Washington Redskins Halloween costume football helmet. So I'm riding a moped up and down Connecticut and Wisconsin Avenue, in and out of Montgomery County in Northwest DC. Eyes closed, Redskins football helmet, and your hands are freezing. On my way out of the house, I took my mom's yellow rubber dish gloves. So I'm wearing yellow rubber dish gloves on the moped. You know, on the old Georgetown Road, it goes from three lanes to two as you come in from Rockville to Bethesda, right in front of Suburban Hospital and NIH, that area, if you're familiar. I got hit by a Metro bus. You know, this was the kind of stuff that was happening regularly. It was just like people would take pictures of me. They would post it on the internet on these like Facebook pages, I guess. I don't have Facebook. I did back then, but I didn't really know how to use it. They would post it on these Facebook pages of like, that guy's an idiot. You know what I mean? It was just pictures of me in a dead skin's helmet, you know, motoring down and pouring freezing rain. I mean, that's what I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with, right? So you get the picture. I'm an idiot. I am the village idiot of Montgomery County, Maryland. And it was a far cry from all the things my parents set up for me. All boys parochial schooling, lots of sports, went off to college to play sports, right? You know, and all these nice things, and I looked like this nice kid. And at this point in my life, I was completely addicted to plastic bottle vodka and crack cocaine, you know. And not like the other kids in my neighborhood. They all had like blonde or red hair, and like all of them were named like Timmy or Michael, you know, like just this was the most vanilla Smallville looking town. And this is what I had to give back to my parents after all they had done for me. And so what happened was I woke up on St. Patrick's Day, 2013. And for years I've been, you know, barely holding on to this job, which they paid me nothing for because I did nothing. I like changed the toilet paper, this office building. I mean, I worked for an IT company, but they didn't trust me with doing anything other than changing TP. And I would work at bars at night. Oh God, I worked at some bars. I used to go and drink all night at this outdoor crab house called Steamer's Crab House in Bethesda, Maryland. Some old landowner in Bethesda built it for his son. It was literally a circus tent, no insulation, nothing. And they didn't serve seafood. They served like month-old crabs if you were to order food there. These are the sorts of bars that you get thrown into rather than thrown out of, you know what I mean? And it was a special place. You had everything in there. You had degenerate gamblers, drunks, drug addicts, alcoholics. You needed, right? You know the saying, you probably heard of Alcoholics Anonymous before. You needed 32 customers for a full set of teeth, you know? And it was incredible. Forget about ladies' night. The types of women that came into this place would walk in and look as if they had done their makeup on a trampoline. You know, those were the women that I was attracting at that time in my life. And I woke up on St. Patrick's Day after ripping and running for pretty much 10 years. You know, I got out of high school. I was about to turn 28. I got out of high school and miraculously, basically because my parents paid, you know, I got out of high school. And lasted another 10 or so years. And I woke up on St. Patrick's Day on my cousin's sofa in downtown D.C. and asked him to take me home. And he knew that I hadn't spoken to my parents in several years. He also knew that when I said, take me home, that, you know, the manner in which I said that, he knew exactly where I wanted him to take me. And he was like, are you sure? The last time he had taken me there was like probably 5 years prior. And I swallowed a handful of psychedelic mushrooms before going in and talking to my retired Marine Corps father, which you can imagine went over really well. And I said, yeah, he took me home and, you know, we're alcoholics, always the grandstander, you know, and I went in there and sobbed to my father's huge. I don't know what happened to me, but he's a very large guy and I'm sobbing and he's silent, you know, just has no patience for me. And, then my mother helps me to look through treatment facilities and I tell him, I said, look, I'll go wherever, you know, you think I need to go, but I'm telling you right now, I know for a fact, I just need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll tell you why I said that. For years, I had come to Alcoholics Anonymous, getting my slip signed, meeting nice people, just like all of you here, people greeting me outside the door, showing me where these cookies that I didn't get to eat are because I dang traffic on 66. And these people, when I was coming in to get my slip sign, made sure that I reflected positively on people in the places that I visited in Alcoholics Anonymous even before I was ready to get sober. You know, it was crucial that they did that because I felt safe to come back. I don't know what it was about those meetings when I wasn't getting sober, but I didn't want to drink a bottle of vodka after. I might have wanted to drink half a bottle of vodka, you know, but it had, I couldn't have put it into words at the time, but I felt a little lighter leaving those AA meetings, even when I had no intention of staying sober. In fact, I think I was trying to sell like fake weed at AA meetings when I was getting my slips. I was a real idiot, you know? And I'm so grateful that those people did that. But they reached their hand out to me. They asked me for my phone number. They checked on me, even when I wasn't going to a meeting. They said, "Hey, do you want to come to this meeting tonight? Hey, we're going here. We're going bowling. We're doing this. We're doing that." And I thought it was all silly. But when I was at the end of the road, I knew those people would be there, and they were. It was the Midtown group. And I got sober in this big group of young alcoholics in Bethesda, Maryland. When I came in, we were having a meeting at Bethesda Chevy Chase High School. 450 of us showing up every Sunday. And I got a full recognition of what Alcoholics Anonymous was, you know, at that point when I finally had nobody left. You know, and sure, a lot of bad stuff happened prior to that point. There are people that I lost in my life. There are things that I'm never getting back, people that are never coming back, you know, people that refuse to come back. And thank God for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the people that came before me that cared about the steps and the traditions and even the concepts, you know, and they showed me how to work this program. You know, because as progressive of a disease as alcoholism, recovery has been progressive too. You know, we talk about the rock in the pond and the ripple effect that we have in our drinking on those around us. My recovery has had that same ripple effect on people around me in Alcoholics Anonymous, in my family, people I never thought would speak to me again, calling me. Getting sober. I'm the first member of my family to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I've been through amazing things. But what is that? What was that experience when I got to the Midtown group that Sunday in 2013? It was people getting people sober, is what it was. It was hope in human form, right? And I've never seen God in a meeting, right? But I noticed that he's here, you know? And what it's been in my experience, and as it pertains to these paragraphs, and I'm a guy who thought he knew God, right? Like all of us, we got it. I was a college dropout theology major. I didn't know anything about God, you know? I knew how to like write about books and stuff. But my experience is that God has used the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous as a spiritual conduit to dispel his love and grace upon me in my life. You know? So I came into AA and got my job back, which was wild. I got a sponsor. He told me to stop riding my moped around. I went to my first meeting. I think I told this story 5 years ago. Bill would probably get mad at me. It's not that funny. It's kind of funny. So I got to my first meeting on this moped, right, with this Redskins, Deadskins helmet and yellow rubber dish gloves. And I get there, and I remember this meeting because I used to get my slip sign there. And if you've been to the Midtown group, especially 10 years ago, it was like, I'm 27, I'm single. And I get there, and there's all these gorgeous people in there. I mean, there's all these young people getting sober. There's all these gorgeous women, these happy guys. They're all hanging out there. Ripping darts and high-fiving and telling jokes, and they all have service, And I get there, and this is pretty attractive, you know, for a guy who's really had not known where he's going to sleep at any given time, any night, you know, for the last several years. This was really attractive. And the first thing I thought to myself was, I'm going to get one of these girls to go home with me. I'm going to start flirting with some of these girls. They're cute. They look like they got money. Maybe they'll buy me a Chipotle. And, you know, that was like going to Ruth Chris Steakhouse back there. So I pulled up on my moped, took my helmet off. It's raining, of course, it's March. And I go in, and I remember this meeting was the Kenston Big Book Study. 200 people would show up, and they would do these big rectangles. They would form this big rectangle of tables. And if you sat around the tables, you would more than likely have to read from the chapter. They read a chapter every week. And if you sat in the rows that backed up the tables, you didn't read. But so I was like, I'm gonna go in there, I'm gonna show these people I can read. And I'm gonna sit down at the table, and I'm gonna read from two employers, and I'm totally unemployed, and I look like it. I'd been detoxing for days in my mother's basement behind my father's back. He didn't want me in the house, and she would sneak me in. And I'm, you know, losing it. You got detoxing bad. And it had been 3 days. St. Patrick's Day was on a Sunday that year, so this was a Tuesday. I started feeling pretty good about Tuesday. Good enough that I was like, I'm gonna go to a meeting. And I signed up for the intake that week, you know, for the, I think I signed up for an intensive outpatient program at Suburban Hospital, but whatever. So I'm going to the meeting. I used to get one of my slips signed, and I ride up there. I get in there, I sit down at the tables right in the middle of everybody. There's 200 people there. And I sit down, I'm reading to employers, going through, just coming around the tables. It's not my turn yet, but it's coming up to my turn. And I remember it clear as day, the doors that I came through when I came into the meeting. And I start feeling hot, and I'm sweating, right? All the delirium tremens are returning. I'm getting real hot. I'm fire engine red, and I'm sweating. And it's coming around to my turn to talk about the alcoholic employee here and two employers. And it gets right up to where it's about to be my turn to read. And I shit my pants in front of the 200 people in the meeting and all the girls that I was going to flirt with and take home. And that was my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, some people laughed. Some people didn't. But I'll tell the people that didn't laugh. People who did laugh have miscalculated a fart for a shit. And I'm in AA for the first time without a slip, actually trying to stay sober. And all these people grabbed a hold of me after the meeting, and we just started praying. And they kept asking me for my number, and I was so embarrassed. I didn't have a cell phone at this point. If I had a cell phone, I probably wouldn't have gotten sober. By this point, I had no phone, no nothing other than that moped. And I didn't have a number. I didn't have the heart to tell them. But they told me where the meeting was the next night. I went home and dusted myself off and cleaned myself up. And by the following day, I felt welcome enough that I could go back. And I showed up on Wednesday night at the Rockville 12 Steps and 12 Traditions meeting, you know. And again, it was Alcoholics Anonymous doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, you know, people carrying me, you know. And people asked me what I was doing on the weekend, you know. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it had been years before I had met a group of people who wanted to hang out with me on consecutive weekends. You know, I mean, I drove people nuts on the weekend because that's when I really, you know, would let loose. You know, I'd let loose in public, you know, and because I thought that's what everyone did. I'm reminiscing here and thinking of a lot of old times. But what happened is, like I said, my sponsor told me to stop riding that moped. I got my job back. I got a used car. And I started taking a meeting to the A1 East Men's Shelter in Southeast DC. You know, for 2 years, I took that meeting down there on Friday nights. I had this gorgeous girlfriend. My job was starting to like don't know if they trusted me. That took a lot of years, but because I got the same job that I had before, and at about 2 years sober, she decided to leave me for somebody else in the program, and I felt more alone than I'd ever felt in my life, you know, and I felt worse without a drink than I ever did drinking, you know, and I began to burn my life down in sobriety. I crashed my car on purpose in front of my office. I show up to AA functions, acting belligerent, crazy, and you know, you would see me walking through meetings, and you know, people would be talking about this God topic and talking about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm walking through the meeting like thinking I know something, and I'm saying, you know, jackass, you know, I'm like, I think I'm like a know-it-all in Alcoholics Anonymous, and all my relationships fell away from me, you know, and what happened was is my sponsor at the time, I've been taking this meeting down. I've been going through the motions, right? I've been doing two-thirds of our triangle. I've been going to meetings and I've been doing service, but I hadn't been doing recovery because as soon as I had gotten through that fifth step and I got the girlfriend, got the job, got the car, got the house, you know, I didn't feel like I had anything else left to gain here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he said, look, Tim, if you don't start taking other men through 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to die. Yeah, I didn't believe anything this guy said ever. And for the first time, I really believed every single word that he said to me because I felt it. I was dying in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, just waiting for someone to give me a reason, a good enough reason to drink. And, you know, what happened was is at that time, so I lost the girl, was about to lose the job. And my roommate at the time, she comes down here and speaks all the time, Joyce. She and I were living together in Bethesda. And she just got engaged. And we had this guy move in with us, this crazy guy. He was like straight out of a freaking WWF show or something. He was wild. He used to come to this group actually. And this guy, Chris Porter, he moves in with us. And Chris was raised in like a trailer south of Tampa by himself, like raised himself, like Mowgli, you know, like just a wild dude. And he moves in, and me, Chris, and Joyce are there one Sunday night. I'm miserable, right? I'm complaining about my life. He comes in the door. He wasn't a big guy, or you thought he was, but he certainly tried to act the tough guy. He came home Sunday night after Midtown, and he was bawling his eyes out. So I'm getting lectures from my sponsor that I'm going to die. My roommate's coming home, and he's bawling his eyes out because he just dropped his two children off with their mother, and for the first time in his sobriety, me and him got sober together. We weren't like really close friends. We were friends, but then we became close friends when we moved in together. And he had for the first time in his sobriety realized that when he dropped his two kids off, he was dropping them off in essentially a crack house. You know, she was living in a basement. His two children, he had a 6-year-old girl and a 4-year-old boy, and he had them when he was very young, and they were never married. They never even figured out any sort of custody or child support. And they're both, you know, really sick people. And he got sober and she didn't. And they had never been to school. They were going to bed with bottles of Coca-Cola every night and their baby teeth were rotting out of their mouth. And they were living in a trash-filled basement that they had paths, you know, around the trash in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And he came home and finally, I think he had gone in the house that night, walked him in. And maybe he had some questions about why his 6-year-old wasn't in kindergarten or something along those lines. And he realized the state of the place and he realized what she was doing was she was just living to do whatever she needed to do to get what she needed to stay to survive. And these kids were kind of an afterthought. the things that they were a witness to. And he came home crying. He looked at me and Joyce, and he said, "Go back and get them, and don't ever take them back there." So now my problems aren't as big, right? Because somebody else, I'm becoming invested in someone else's problems. And Joyce is a assistant state's attorney in Frederick County at the time, and she and I and him sit down and we file all the paperwork to get a emergency order to take emergency custody of these two children. Now, Chris is an admitted crackhead, and so am I. And we're living in Bethesda, Maryland, in this really nice neighborhood, but really old, dumpy house because the rent was really cheap, and all the other houses are like glorious. And he's like Joe Dirt, and I'm like this preppy looking, wussy looking kid from Kensington. And now all of a sudden we have two children moving in with us. And when my sponsor told me I had to take people through the 12 steps or I was going to die, he knew that if I didn't start taking other people through the 12 steps, that I wasn't going to finish the steps. So my solution to that side of the problems in my life was I went to the shelter and I told every homeless guy in the treatment recovery program at 81 East that if they did a fifth step, they could move in with me in Bethesda. They didn't have to take a housing voucher and move back into the projects. So we take custody of a six-year-old girl and a four-year-old boy. Then we have two older homeless men from Anacostia, D.C. move in, and they're sleeping on our sofas. And Chris is learning how to be a father for the first time in his life. I'm learning how to be a father just by being adjacent. And these two guys out of the A1 East Men's Shelter are learning how to be fathers to these two little white kids that they have no relationship with. And we're all ripping cigarettes, walking the kids to the bus stop in the morning to go to Bethesda Elementary, And I'll tell you some amazing things happen, right? I stopped thinking about my problems and stopped crashing my car on purpose and stopped acting like a belligerent maniac in Alcoholics Anonymous. I probably started sponsoring way too many people. I started taking about 20 to 25 guys every Friday and every Sunday night down to the A1 East Men's Shelter. And we would take a meeting in there on Friday, and then we would work a transportation, bringing them up to Midtown on Sunday. And those kids got so attached to those guys that were living on the sofa, right? So they would move in, they'd be on our sofas for like a month while we helped them find a job in Montgomery County. They're working the steps. They're going to meetings every night. They're getting jobs wherever, the hardware store, the Harris Teeter, the Safeway, wherever, and moving in with other sober people in Alcoholics Anonymous just on the north side of the city. And me and Chris are learning how to like co-parent these children. And those kids turned out to be straight A students. And me and some of these guys were reading out of the big book with Madison when she was 7 years old, and she was learning how to read out of the big book. So I'm working program, he's working program. These homeless guys from Anacostia are working program, and these kids are working more program than all of us. It's funny, I mean, I can tell you. These guys used to teach these kids going to Bethesda Elementary. They were like 5 and 7 at the time, and they would go and they would tell their teacher. They would teach them how to make food that they used to make in jail with ramen noodles and onions and all this other nonsense. And they would go to their fancy Bethesda Elementary and they would ask for basically prison meals. They would say, "Well, are we ever going to have hookups at lunchtime?" Which is a DC prison term for what you're doing with ramen noodles and protein powder and onions and mustard and nonsense. And I mean, it was amazing the way all of us were helping each other. It was a perfect ecosystem of recovery. We'd get home from work every day at 5 p.m. and there'd be like six guys on our front stoop just ripping cigarettes. They all took the bus there. They're just waiting to pile into the car so we can go to the Kensington Big Book Study or Up the Tubes or Unity Club or some meeting, whatever night of the week was. And was the best time of my life. You know, I finally took that used car, and I remember at that time I bought a family car to transport my buddy and his kids around. I'm the one who bought the station wagon. They used to come to Christmas with my family. We used to go on beach trips together. And I'll tell you, Chris ultimately ended up moving down this further into Virginia, down this way. I think he lives down in Fredericksburg now. I just talked to his father while I was driving down here. And he's married, and those two kids are straight A students, and they've never drank or done drugs in their life. They're in high school. They're killing it. They're going to get scholarships. They're killing it. He takes them up on the weekends to Penn State football games. His wife's from State College, Pennsylvania. They all wear Penn State football jerseys. They want to go to Penn State. They have no relationship with their mother. But Catherine, their stepmother, is like a saint, me, I moved into and they eventually our house fell apart, literally. It was the furnace blew up, and I had nothing to do with it. But I ended up buying a house in Kensington, Maryland, and moving a ton of roommates in, and continuing to do the same thing. Try to do it as often as I can, helping other alcoholics. I was there, and we would have 5 people living there, including me, and people sleeping on the couches, people sleeping on the porch, just trying to get to the next meeting. And what happened was, is this girl that I had asked out like 50 times, who said no to me 50 times. She was from Baltimore, AA. She's from the Hatchery Group up in Towson. And she moved down to DC. She called me one day. So my phone, it was right around the time, actually, shortly after I spoke here. And she called me and asked me out on a date. I'm just like, sure. I'll be there in 30 minutes. And she was like, my sponsor thinks I should get guys with a good program, like financially responsible. That's what she said to me. I was like, of course, it's me. I'm responsible. And 6 months later, she got pregnant. And 6 months after that, we had COVID. And 6 months after that, she got pregnant again. 6 months after that, 9 months after that, we got married. And 6 months after that, she got pregnant again. And we've been together for 4-something years, married for 2. And we've got 3 gorgeous children. And I'm the best dad in the world because of Alcoholics Anonymous. When those kids moved in with us, our home group launched a bunch of GoFundMe campaigns because we were both broke. We had no money. All we had was a few years sobriety to our name, and we paid our rent on time. That's all we had, and some used cars that we were fixing on the weekends in the driveway. We had nothing. In our home group, the Midtown group did a GoFundMe so we could buy toys, so we could buy bunk beds. So we could sign them up for camp as little kids. I mean, these kids were raised by Alcoholics Anonymous, like really raised by Alcoholics Anonymous, every aspect. We would have babysitters come if, like, Chris had to speak at one meeting and I had to speak at another meeting. Other members of the group would come and babysit kids. And we had a beautiful life. We didn't have any of the material things, but we had a lot of God. We had a lot of love. And I've been trying to replicate that for probably the past 7, 8 years in my house. Hold on to that. Life has gotten really good. Like I said, I have these two beautiful girls and this newborn son. And my career is, I'm doing a lot more than changing toilet paper. My career is doing really well. And, you know, it's just, what is all this? I mean, none of this is me. All of it is Alcoholics Anonymous. All of it is God, you know. I don't, you know, I can't count how many guys came through the house. You know, everyone I ever lived with before Alcoholics Anonymous is dead. Every single one. The only guy that's alive was my one college roommate who made it to Alcoholics Anonymous in Charlotte, North Carolina. You know, people are dying out there all the time. My old roommate Chris is at a funeral right now. First cousin who just overdosed, you know. And, you know, as it pertains to this paragraph, you know, I don't know what that is other than an act of God, all of that stuff. You cannot get to where I am today, from where I came from, without Alcoholics Anonymous. And you cannot get Alcoholics Anonymous without a loving higher power. You know, this is amazing that all of us are here on a Sunday night. That I drove 2 hours. I missed the Deadskins game, you know. But, you know, I don't have a whole lot of bright light experiences, but God, I've been blessed since I got here. I mean, this is the single greatest moment of my life is Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything else is secondary. You know, the only thing that even comes close is when I took my first drink. You know, I've been given a brand new life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new and you want your old life back, you're not going to get your old life back. I didn't want my old life back because my old life sucked. But I got a brand new life because of you guys. You know, so thanks for listening to me ramble. And, you know, I beg you, if you're new, if you're in your first meeting or your last meeting, I always say this, I hope you stick around and work these steps because I know that there's a miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous for each and every one of us. You know, so please, please get in here and work the steps and take the steps every day. Thanks for the share.
Yeah.